Sullivan Show.
The Sullivan Show.
On City Talk 105.9.
A very good afternoon to you. It's just hitting 2:05. Still to come on The Sullivan Show. After 3, we get out of the studio and into the City Cafe, catching up with all the entertainment news from Miss Ali McBride. Stephen Guy of National Museums in Liverpool recounts true stories from our very own River Mersey maritime history. We discover more about the life and works of Mrs. Hemans, the most published writer of the 19th century, who was born right here in Liverpool in Duke Street. And if you've got an eye for design, Boodles and Open Culture are looking for new and talented designers to create a single item of jewellery or trophy to celebrate Liverpool 2008 Capital of Culture. So that's still to come on The Sullivan Show.
This is The Sullivan Show.
On City Talk 105.9.
In conversation with Dean. On City Talk 105.9.
And this hour, I'm in conversation with my special guest in the studio. Joining me is Rose Dixon. Good afternoon, Rose.
Hello there.
What are you working at the moment?
At the moment, I'm the National Training and Development Officer for SAM National. That's Support After Murder and Manslaughter.
Right, so how did you get involved in that?
I got involved in bereavement issues after my daughter died 16 years ago, and I did some work with the Compassionate Friends, which is bereaved parents, supporting bereaved parents, and that's the death of a child through any cause.
And how did you find them?
I don't know, I can't remember far back. Probably somebody suggested I contacted them, but I did a lot of work with the Compassionate Friends, and then I saw the job with SAM National advertised, and I applied for it and got it.
Excellent. So just take us back to that time then. You said that, did your daughter then die suddenly, if you don't mind me asking?
She was living up in Yorkshire, and we got a telephone call one Friday afternoon. It was actually the tea time, just to say that Avril had collapsed and gone unconscious, and the paramedics had been called and they couldn't resuscitate her. It subsequently turned out that she actually had a chest infection and had complained to the doctor that she was tired and lethargic, and the doctor said, oh, you've got depression, and gave us some antidepressants. What the doctor actually missed was that she actually had pneumonia. So she died of a combination of pneumonia and poisoning with clinically prescribed drugs. Because your liver metabolises the drug and you excrete it through your kidneys and your urine. And because she had pneumonia, she had a very high temperature, she wasn't actually passing any urine. So she was retaining the dose of the drug in her body.
It seems extraordinary that a doctor would overlook that.
Absolutely unbelievable, yeah. In fact, there were 3 GPs and a hospital consultant involved in her death.
And were you able to sort of follow it up? Did you bring any sort of a case of neglect?
We did try, but it's very difficult. I became very angry because my background is a clinical nurse specialist, and I felt the doctors were talking down to me. It was a case of, there, poor dear, we know you're a little bereaved mother. Which made me very angry, and I knew there was something wrong. And I actually investigated her death and discovered what had happened. So I got one of the GPs disciplined, and the hospital consultant is no longer practicing.
It's never really enough, though, is it?
Not really, but, what would bring her back? Nothing, you know. At least at the end of the day, I got an apology from the hospital, and they did admit that if their consultant had done her job properly, Avril would still be alive today. We would have liked to have had a corporate manslaughter charge, but that wasn't possible.
Did you find, was it a case of a lot of people closing ranks?
Yes, absolutely. The hospital refused to talk to me, and I wrote a letter to them and I said, I'm not going away. 20 years from now, I will still be knocking on your door. You may have moved on or retired, but I will still be hounding the hospital. And I put in my letter, I'm not suing the hospital and I'm not suing the doctors, but I insist on knowing why my daughter died. And as soon as I put in writing that I wasn't suing, every door opened to me, and I got every piece of information in relation to her death.
It's interesting.
It is.
So there you are in that situation. How long after your daughter collapsed, Rose, was it before she died?
She collapsed and died, there and then.
Right.
Yeah. The paramedics couldn't revive her.
So you are actually getting this telephone call and receiving this news. And then how did you deal with it?
I think initially that Friday evening, our house was in chaos. You know, we were contacting her sister, who was at university in Birmingham, contacting my sister and her family who live in North Wales, contacting very close friends and other family members. We were having phone calls to and from the coroner's office and contacting undertakers. And it really is, looking back on it, that evening was actually a very funny evening. At the time, it didn't appear to be funny, but some months later, a friend asked me that question, what happened immediately afterwards, and I started to tell her what happened that evening, and there were lots of funny things that happened, but they're only funny now when I look back on them. They weren't at the time.
So what made you feel that you needed either some sort of professional help or guidance to help you deal with this, you know, news of sudden death of your child?
I tried some professional help, and as a professional myself, I had been working as a cancer nurse specialist. I had been working as a cruise bereavement counsellor at that time also, and I thought I knew quite a lot about bereavement. But unfortunately, with the personal experience, you realise that knowing it from a book is not the same as knowing it through experience. And I found the professional counsellors were not terribly helpful. No disrespect to them, but they couldn't give me what I wanted. And eventually I spoke to, we actually went on a coach trip to Lourdes, my husband and I, and we met up with a group of mothers from the Compassionate Friends. I think there were about five of them. And they were all bereaved mothers. And it was just utterly unbelievable to be with these women who understood how I felt. They could understand me doing silly things like in between Avril's death and her funeral, a friend was coming to take me to the Chapel of Rest to see Avril, and my husband and I had gone shopping to the supermarket, came home, put the shopping away, and I always kick off my shoes in the hall. And when I go out, I'll wear another pair of shoes, and when I come home, kick off the shoes in the hall, and eventually my husband gets irritated, scoops them up and throws them in the bedroom. And we came back, kicked my shoes off in the hall, put the shopping away. My friend arrived, and I wanted to wear the same pair of shoes, but I couldn't find them. And we searched the house. I had a row with my husband because I swore he'd moved them and he swore he hadn't. And eventually my friend started to humour me, and she said, let's go and sit down and we'll have a cup of coffee. So we went into the kitchen, and she put the kettle on, and I went to the fridge to get the milk, and I found my shoes in the fridge.
How did they get there?
I'd actually put the shoes in the fridge and the milk in the hall. And I thought, that's it, you have lost the plot. Mm. You are now going to be sectioned and put away in a mental institution. It was a very, very frightening experience. But when I met these bereaved mums, they'd all done silly things like that. Mm. And it was a case of, oh, thank God for that, I thought I was going mad.
It's obvious that your mind is elsewhere, distracted, obviously.
Absolutely. Mm. You don't know what day of the week it is.
I'm in conversation with Rose Dixon this hour. You're listening to City Talk 105. Point nine. Do you think there's lots of people out there, Rose, who think that they can just deal with, you know, for your in your example, you know, sudden death, and just get on with it, and it's just like it's part of life, and you'll get over it and move on?
Yes, I do, and I have to be honest with you and say, from my work as a cancer nurse, I think Liverpool people or Merseyside people have got some special quality. It's a case of, you know, they do just get on with it. You know, no matter what you throw at them, they sort of pick themselves up and keep going. I think more so than people in other areas in the country.
But I think we've got this history of resilience anyway, haven't we, as Scousers,
absolutely,
as Liverpudlians?
Yeah. And I think also, although we're quite a big area now, the Merseyside area, I think we've got very much a community type of feeling in Liverpool and the Merseyside area. You know, wherever you go in the world, if you say you're from Liverpool or near Liverpool or Merseyside, you'll always find somebody else who's been there, and immediately, you know, you're like best friends.
Mm-hmm. Take us through that process then. How can somebody, a counsellor or whatever, help a bereaved parent in particular?
I think certainly if I'm dealing with bereaved parents, one of the first things I say to them is that I'm also a bereaved parent. You know, I've lost a daughter. I don't know how you're feeling, but I have an idea that I might know a little bit about how you feel. And I'm here to listen if you want to talk to me. And it's very much more about listening rather than talking. I train volunteers to work for SAM. And they are people who have been bereaved themselves through homicide. And when I do the training days, they come along and they're looking for magic words to say to people on the telephone when people phone in. And they're quite amazed when I say to them, the most important thing to learn is to keep your mouth shut and listen. Because those people just want to tell their story and talk about how they feel.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your work before you you know, got involved in the process of dealing with bereavement.
Oh, how far back do you want to go?
Well, you mentioned that you were you looking after cancer sufferers?
Yes, I used to work at Clatterbridge on the oncology unit.
And what did that involve?
Well, it involved looking after radiotherapy, chemotherapy patients, and eventually I actually specialised just in radiotherapy. And I used to look after patients who were coming very much as an outpatient, you know, coming on a daily basis for their radiotherapy treatment. And I would liaise between the radiographers, the nurses and doctors, and be, if you like, the link between all of those people.
And did you lose many of those patients?
Yes, inevitably you lose some, but, you know, a huge number of cancer patients get better nowadays. You know, the cure rate is really on the increase. And I have to say, I was working on the radiotherapy unit when my daughter died, and the consultant I worked with, I went off sick for 2 months, and when I came back, he took me into his office my first day back, and he said to me, I hope you don't mind and I hope you're not cross with me, but he said, all our patients know you very well, and everybody was saying, where's Rose? Why isn't Rose here? And he said, I actually told them that Avril had died. He said, I hope you didn't mind me doing that. And I said, no, not at all. You know, I'd rather you tell them the truth than lie to them. And it just overwhelmed me when patients started coming into clinic to see me, how many of them were supportive towards me. They were incredible. In spite of the fact that they're battling cancer and all the awful side effects of treatment, they were supporting me, and that was actually very special for me.
What makes you want to be involved in that sort of work? Is it, did you have to have special attributes to be dealing with people basically who are suffering, aren't they?
Yes, people are suffering, but again, the attitude of people is amazing. You know, they're full of fun and full of humour. I mean, I was at a meeting a few weeks ago in the Toxteth area, and we had the chief constable and some MPs and various other people, and a lady stood up and she was pouring out her heart about how angry she was about her daughter being murdered and about, you know, this man is going to be set free onto the streets of Liverpool soon. And she's talking very, very loudly and very quickly, and in the middle of it all, it's sort of, oh, hang on a minute, I'm losing my teeth. And then she just carried on. And the whole place was falling about with laughter. And one of the people on the panel said, only in Liverpool could you get this tragedy mixed with humour.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. I'm talking to my special guest this hour. I'm in conversation with Rose Dixon. So after the death of your daughter, then, is that what sort of, and then you went through the process of getting some counselling, you were saying, and some help as far as the bereavement was concerned. And then did that sort of trigger you in a certain direction?
It did. I wouldn't be where I am now if Avril hadn't died. And then 6 years after Avril died, my surviving daughter, Penny, had married and had two children. And she had a third pregnancy, and that baby was born premature. And he was born in Stafford, because they had to transfer her. There were no intensive care cots in Birmingham. He was transferred to Stafford, and he was born there. And then 4 weeks later, he was transferred back to Birmingham. And when he was 12 weeks old, he actually died in my arms. They turned the ventilator off. So I've lost a daughter and a grandson.
You're listening to City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool.
City. Century. Every Friday at 12, our financial expert Ian Haworth from Parker Kelly Financial Services will be live in the studio to answer all your financial questions. So if you need advice on anything from mortgages and pensions to credit card debt, give our expert a call on 0151 708 1059 or email us surgery@citytalk.fm. For free expert advice, listen to the City Surgery. Weekdays at 12. We're here to help.
City Talk 105.9. City Talk 105.9.
Developing partnerships, creating opportunities, growing sales. City Talk 105.9 presents an exciting opportunity to advertise your business to a whole new audience.
My name's Ian Parker. I'm managing partner with Parker Kelly Financial Services. We're independent financial advisors and we're based in Liverpool City Centre in Stanley Street. We've been advertising with City Talk now since the beginning of 08, and I've got nothing but praise for the relationship, how well we've been supported, lots of open dialogue, lots of clear communication. We've had an extremely positive reaction from existing clients, and also we've brought in some new work from it. I think the service is really competitively priced, and I'd urge anyone who hasn't tried radio advertising to give it a go.
To make sure we're talking about your business, call Gillian Taylor now on 472-6866 and ask how we can help grow your profits. City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool.
City Talk Tower Tours are running again, giving you the chance to see the ever-changing signature skyline of Liverpool from 450 feet above the city centre. Take in the breathtaking panoramic views of the Wirral, Lancashire, the Welsh Hills and beyond, and go behind the scenes of our state-of-the-art studios. There are tours every weekend, as well as twilight tours on Tuesday and Thursday evenings. Book now on 0151 472 6800 or log on to citytalk.fm/tower tours.
So why is everyone doing the Adidas Women's 5K Challenge?
I'm doing it because she's doing it.
I'm doing it because she is.
The Adidas Women's 5K Challenge, September the 7th, Sefton Park, Liverpool. Get some friends together and sign up today at womenschallenge.co.uk.
We're doing it together!
Adidas. Impossible is nothing.
Phil and Kim at breakfast with Lucas Vauxhall.
Forthcoming season, Liverpool, what do you reckon?
I don't really expect them to win the championship, but I expect them to make a better fist of it in terms of getting closer to the top. There's been, I think, too much pressure on Gerrard and Torres to really be the main goal scorers and to provide the spark for Liverpool.
I wonder if you'd be at all embarrassed about talking to your kids about this.
Liverpool FC is hard as hell. United, Tottenham,
I've seen this to them. What are you talking about? I'm not embarrassed. This is my finest moment. Never mind all those goals I've scored.
John, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
The legend that is John Barnes.
Waking up Merseyside.
Phil and Kim at breakfast.
City Talk 105.9. This is The Sullivan Show.
With Dean Sullivan.
On City Talk 105.9. In conversation with Dean. On City Talk 105.9.
Yes, you're listening to The Sullivan Show with me, Dean Sullivan, on City Talk 105.9. In conversation with my special guest for this hour, Rose Dixon. Rose, you're not from Liverpool, are you?
No, originally I was born in Dublin and moved over to Liverpool, to Wavertree, when I was about 6 and a half.
And why did the family come over?
I imagine it was economic reasons. I was too young to know, really.
Okay.
And
so growing up in Wavertree area? Did you go
in
to school
Wavertree,
there?
I went to school, Our Lady of Good Help in Wavertree. And then St Agnes up in Old Swan, which isn't there anymore. I visited it the other day and I was amazed to see a whole housing estate there where the school used to be.
And what was it like going to school in those days? I say in those days, not that far long ago, is it?
Actually, a mixture. I was fine with the children. The children were lovely. They did tease me a lot because I had a very, very strong Irish accent. But I didn't enjoy how I was treated by the teachers. There was actually an awful lot of prejudice against Irish people.
Really?
Oh, huge. It was awful.
And what, for what reason?
I don't know. I think they had this idea that Irish people were very, very poor. And when I was at school, we were all given a letter to take home, and we were told, do not bring this letter back unless it's signed by a parent. And it was to have the BCG vaccination. And when I showed it to my mother, she looked at it and she said, oh, you've already had that. I don't need to sign it. Take it back. And the next morning at assembly, the headmaster said, has anybody brought the letter back unsigned? And I was the only one to put my hand up. And he absolutely humiliated me in front of the whole school. Who the hell did I think I was to think that Ireland would have something before England had it? And, you know, how dare I say that a backward country like Ireland would have anything? And I said, well, my mother said they paid for me to have that vaccination when I was about five. And, it was awful.
And how old were you then when this happened?
I think I was about 11, yeah.
But it's obviously stayed with you.
Oh, yes, absolutely, yes. His prejudice was awful. It really was. And I got similar stuff like that from lots of the teachers. Not all of them, but from quite a few of them.
So that's quite a big thing to have to deal with growing up.
Absolutely. I mean, it's also made me very aware that maybe how people from other ethnic minorities cope, you know, black kids and Asian kids in an all-white school. I think I was probably the only Irish child in my class.
But that sort of behaviour from that headmaster, you know, today that would be child abuse.
Absolutely, yeah. But that was, you know, that was just accepted. You just had to get on with it in those days.
And what was family life like?
It was very difficult at times because my mother wasn't very well. And she was constantly being admitted to hospital. She had a condition whereby she couldn't control her body temperature. So if she got something very simple like an ordinary cold or a sore throat, her temperature would shoot up and she wouldn't be able to get it down. And she'd have to be taken into hospital and packed in ice to try and bring her temperature down. Similarly, if she got very cold, she couldn't bring her temperature up. And she would have to be rushed off to hospital and, you know, warmed up.
And did they know what caused this?
Yes, it was a postpartum hemorrhage after childbirth. And it affects the pituitary gland. It's called Simmons disease.
So did you have brothers and sisters?
Had a sister, one sister, Margaret.
She older?
4 years older than me.
So was
she's going to hate me for saying this on air, because that's the thing we have. I have to tell everybody she's 4 years older than me.
Well, nobody knows how old she is, though, unless you tell us how old you are, which you don't have to do, of course. So did she have to take on the role of mum when mum was in hospital?
I think my father did it very much more than her, because although she was 4 years older than me, she was still quite young. But, you know, I suppose like most sisters, we used to fight and squabble, and I always used to want to go off and go with her and her friends, and she always used to tell me, you can't, you're 4 years younger than me, you can't do it. That's why now I pull her leg and say, but of course you're 4 years older than me, aren't you?
Excellent. And then, so when you left school then, what had you decided on a career? Had you had any ambitions?
No, I didn't know what to do. I worked in a chemist at up at Childwell Five Ways. Then I moved on to clerical work. I worked at Lucas's in, used to be in Edge Lane. Mm. I worked in the drawing office there. Then I met my husband Larry and married. We moved over to Bromborough and had Avril and then Penny.
And so how did you get into nursing?
I was about 28 and I decided it was time for me to go back to work. I was getting a bit bored at home.
You'd had your two children then?
The children were at school and yeah. I was kicking my heels a bit. And I went on a course at Carlett Park called Back to Work. And I just literally took the first one that came up, which was medical receptionist. And it was a course to help you to get a job either as a medical secretary or a doctor's receptionist. And
where did you have to go for that?
Carlet Park.
Right, and who was laying it on? Is that, was it local council or was it
the
government?
I think, I'm not sure whether it was the council or the government, but we got paid for going on the course. And one of the lecturers had been a nurse tutor, and he felt that we couldn't be typing up medical terms without understanding what they meant. So he started doing quite a bit of human biology with us, and I became very, very interested in that, and eventually applied to the old Birkenhead General Hospital to be a nursing auxiliary, and loved that.
And what did that entail? What sort
just
of things?
Helping nurses on the ward, giving out bedpans, making the beds, helping to bed bath patients, things like that. And I enjoyed it, so I applied to do my nursing, and I did 2.5 years part-time to become an enrolled nurse. That's what used to be the bedside nurse. And then a few years later, I applied to do my registered nurse, so I became a registered general nurse then, did 2 more years training. And then I tried lots of different hospitals. I worked as an agency nurse in the Royal, Alderhay, and various other hospitals around the Merseyside area.
So would you just go for a period of time and then
just
send you on somewhere else?
Sometimes it would maybe only be for a few days, but I wanted to see what was out there. And I went to the oncology unit at Clatterbridge, and the minute I went there, I knew that's what I wanted to do. Loved it.
How did you know?
I don't know. My husband says I'm a witch, but definitely, if I am, I'm a white one. I just get gut feelings about things, and the minute I walked onto the oncology unit, I knew this is what I want to do.
Did you have to have specialist training then for that?
No, not when I started there, but, you know, there are all sorts of qualifications you can do now. At the time, they didn't have them. It was just purely experience.
And how long did that last for?
Maybe 15, maybe 20 years.
And did you see some changes over that time?
Huge amount of changes, yes. Nowadays, you really only have your registered nurses. You have very few enrolled nurses. And I think
And
now,
why is that? Is that because the system's changed?
I don't know. They wanted to give the nurses the opportunity to convert. I think the biggest difference I see now when I visit a hospital is that everything's computer orientated. The nurses seem to have to spend a lot of time on the computer, whereas we actually spent 95% of our time with the patients. I think that's the big difference I see.
And what's the difference between an enrolled nurse and a registered nurse?
It's a different level of training.
Right. So what brought about a career change for you then? Because you moved out of nursing.
Well, I was working on a big research project, which was called the cyclotron trial, a very large, fancy radiotherapy machine at Clatterbridge. And it was the only one of its type in the UK. And we were doing a research project with a similar facility out in Seattle and some in Europe. And it was a multi-centre trial, and I really enjoyed that side of it, which was looking at the research side. But I was very fortunate in that the consultant I worked with, he was very keen on the people aspect as well. So I had a completely free rein to do what I wanted in relation to how I dealt with the patients. So I felt very strongly that patients actually needed some psychological help. You know, they needed to have the opportunity to talk, to really discuss what was going on. They would all have my phone number. They could phone me any time, day or night. And I would go out and do home visits on them after they'd been discharged. If the patient wasn't very well, because it was a very specialised type of treatment, I had the experience to actually phone the unit and say, I need Mrs. Bloggs to be readmitted. I've ordered an ambulance, she's on her way in, which at that time nurses didn't do. But the consultants that I worked with actually said that they would back me 100% if I said somebody needed to be admitted, I was to, you know, admit them. So,
and what sort of problems would some people have?
If you have radiotherapy treatment to your abdomen, sometimes after treatment, your bowel can go into almost a sort of paralysis, and the patient may feel sick, they may vomit, they may have diarrhoea, and sometimes it's mistaken as just, you know, side effects of the radiotherapy affecting the bowel, but there's this underlying condition which is like a paralytic ileus, which is part of the bowel going becoming paralysed, and they can actually have an obstruction, and that is a dire emergency. You need help quickly.
And how would you recognise that then?
Mainly because over the years experience, but also knowing my patients very well, because my patients came to me and the consultant I worked with initially. All through their treatment, they were with the two of us, and all through their follow-up for many years afterwards, that we were in very close contact with them. So as a very experienced nurse, and there's thousands of nurses out there who are doing this today, you just look at a patient and you get a gut feeling there's something going wrong here.
In many ways, you were acting as a doctor as well, weren't you?
No, I don't think any doctors out there would like that. I'll have to say no to that.
But, as you've already said, you were very interested in research. Obviously, you had a lot of experience because you could recognise things. Mm-hmm. That's the only allusion I was making.
Yeah, well, okay. I'll go with that.
I wasn't going to disparage the doctors, not by any means. You're listening to City Talk 105.9. I'm in conversation with my special guest this hour, Rose Dixon. Rose, so how long did that phase of your career last?
I think it lasted for about 18 years, something like that. And then I had...
So you must have dealt with hundreds of patients.
Hundreds and hundreds, yes. Then I had a secondment to Liverpool University to the Department of Clinical Psychology and worked there for a year on a research project. And
what
then
was that?
That
was psychology?
It was looking at the psychological effects of fear of cancer recurrence, because for the patients that do get treatment and it's cleared and it comes back again, we wanted to measure psychologically how patients cope with that. And
how generally do patients cope?
Again, I have to say that the Liverpool patients screwed up our research to
really?
A certain extent. Yes, you got
what they booked the trend.
Yes, they would come along, and some of them. I mean, I worked for that work. My clinical work was at Walton Hospital. And it was extended gradually to a four-year study. And we had patients who, you know, had very little money. They didn't have really good lives. They maybe were heavy drinkers, heavy smokers, poor socioeconomic group. And you would think, my God, these people psychologically are going to be awful. But when you actually did all the psychological tests with them, they weren't too bad, you know, because, okay, I've had a crappy life and I've had to do this and I've had to get over this and I've had to get over that. And now I've got cancer, so what? You know, it's just another thing to deal with. So it really was quite amazing that some of them...
Do you think that attitude helped them during either their treatment or during their illness?
I think it helped them to cope with the day-to-day experience of having cancer. I don't know whether it actually helped them to perhaps overcome it and get better, because they do say that if you've got a real fighting spirit in there, that you can often overcome illness.
And did you see many examples of that?
Oh, yes. I've had patients where I've looked at them and I've thought, you know, you'll be dead by the end of the week. And by the end of the week, they're sitting up and eating and, you know, looking forward to a grandson or somebody being born, or, you know, looking forward to their daughter's wedding. They, you know, they just defy you. And it's wonderful when you see that.
Did you have to deal with situations where people knew that they were probably just going to be dead by the end of the week?
Oh, yes. Yeah, lots of times.
And how'd you cope with that? Do you have a strategy of coping?
I think honesty. You know, I've been in many situations where, I'll give you an example, where I had a gentleman who was dying. He knew he was dying and his wife knew he was dying, but they couldn't discuss it. And because he was a very well-known person on Merseyside, he felt that pressure would be put on his wife to have a very large funeral, and he didn't want that. He wanted a very small, private family and very close friends funeral. And he didn't know how to broach the subject with her. So I sat with him one day, and he started telling me about this. And I said to him, have you not discussed it with her? And he said, no. And I said, well, would you be happy for me to discuss it with her? So when she came back into the room, I said to her, you know, we've just been discussing arrangements for the funeral. I said, do you have any thoughts on that? And she said, no. And we talked through, and she wanted this huge, big funeral, as did all friends and neighbours. And I said, well, actually, he doesn't want that. This is what he wants. And I got the two of them to actually discuss what they wanted. And we actually, they couldn't agree. And eventually I intervened and I said, can I make a suggestion? I said, you can throw it out if you want. But I said, my suggestion is we could do both. We could have a very small private funeral. And then maybe a few months down the line, we could have a big memorial service. And they both sort of looked at me and said, that's it, that's what we'll do. So they were both happy, and it actually got them to talk together.
I'm in conversation with my special guest in the studio, Rose Dixon, and you're listening to City Talk 105.9.
Get in touch with the Voice of Liverpool. Phone us.
Local rate on 0151 708 1059.
Text us.
By texting TALK, then a space, then your message to 61025.
Text costs 25 pence plus your standard network rate.
If it's ever going to cost you more, we'll tell you.
Email us via the website
at citytalk.fm.
Or write to City Talk 105.9.
St John's Beacon, 1 Horton Street, L1, 1RL.
City Talk 105.9.
There's one thing guaranteed to make you feel fantastic, and that's inner confidence. At Spire Murrayfield Hospital Wirral, we understand making a change can make a big difference. From breast augmentation to facial surgery, our expert team of cosmetic surgeons offer advice you can trust and the highest standards of care. Payment options are available, so for a free consultation, call Spire Murrayfield Hospital on 0151 929 5408 or visit spirehealthcare.com/Wirral.
Built-In Kitchen Appliances is the UK's largest independent appliance showroom.
It's everything for your kitchen, all under one very big roof.
With over 2,000 freestanding and built-in appliances on show, including sinks, taps and more, we stock the biggest names in kitchen appliances, including Rangemaster, Maytag, Hotpoint, Stoves, Miele and more.
Call into Belmont Road, Anfield, or visit built-inappliances.net.
Big names, big savings, big showroom. Built-In Kitchen Appliances.
You know, I love Buffet Star. Delicious, mouth-watering, scrumptious, piping hot, healthy Chinese and Thai food. Eat as much as you like for under 6 quid. And talking of squid, do you just love it pan-fried with lashings of salt and chilli?
Mm-hmm. Buffet Star. 60 delicious Thai and Chinese dishes to choose from for less than 6 quid. Buffet Star. Hanover Street, Liverpool. Just round the corner from Central Station.
After a road traffic accident, some things are essential. Same-day replacement car hire, speedy repair and fast, convenient legal advice. Gregory Abrams Davidson are the essential law firm. Call 236 5000 or text CLAIM to 8008 and we'll call you back. Text charged at standard network rate.
This is The Sullivan Show
with Dean Sullivan
on City Talk 105.9. In conversation with Dean on City Talk 105.9.
This hour I'm in conversation with Rose Dixon. It's just gone 20 to 3. Rose, just talking there about that couple, you know, and how you sort of reconciled almost, you know, the fact that they wouldn't talk about, you know, imminent death. Did you find in your experience working in that situation that most people are frightened of dying?
I think a lot of people are frightened about the way they'll die, rather more than actually dying. I think people are afraid that they will die in pain, you know, a long lingering death. I think that's the fear much more than actually dying.
But generally speaking, these days, people don't have that pain, do they?
Well, you still hear odd occasions when people do, but they shouldn't do, because nowadays with good palliative care centres, hospices, that sort of thing shouldn't happen.
Tell us about your experience of Hillsborough.
a friend of mine was in charge of all the support that was at Liverpool Football Club, and he asked me would I go along. He was short of people, and we were based in the Liverpool Football Club in the their main area there, and I met all the Liverpool football team. I have to say that my hero is Kenny Dalglish, not because of his football, but because of the way he behaved towards those fans. He was amazing. He and his wife were there every day from about 8 o'clock in the morning till about 8 or 9 at night, and they would do anything for those fans, and they would do anything for the bereaved people that were there.
What was going on? And just paint a picture for us.
Kenny actually came over to me and to my friend George and said, I need somebody to take over from one of my linesmen. And George said to me, will you go, Rose? And when I went over, there was a linesman sitting at a table with two young boys. I think they were 16 and 17. And he'd been with them for an hour. And these two boys just wanted to talk about what it felt like to be in the middle of that crush. And Kenny introduced me to the boys and asked if they minded if the groundsman went away. And he went back out onto the ground, and Kenny went over and was talking to somebody else. And I sat with those boys for about an hour and a half, and they told me the horror of being crushed in there, the horror of seeing their friends die. And one of them looked over towards Kenny and he said, he's my hero. And I said, do you want to meet him? And he said, yes, please. And I mean, he's Kenny Dalglish, you know, I don't care who he is. I just went over to him and I said, I explained to him and I gave him all the situation, told him a lot of the things the boys had told me. And I said, would you please come over and just say hello to these boys? You know, that would mean so much to them. And he came over and he introduced himself. He sat with them and he chatted to them. And then he shouted over to somebody, anybody got a camera? And somebody produced a camera and we took loads of photographs of him with the boys. And then he called somebody else over and he said, open up the trophy room. And he gave me the camera and he said, stay with them. And he said, take them in. And he said, take lots of photos of them in the trophy room. And I did that. And it was just so lovely for these boys because they were so down. Because they had lost friends. And, to have their hero just come and talk to them and spend time with them was just amazing for them. So I was really impressed with him and with all the other players. They were all there. And Kenny's wife also, she was wonderful.
So that was a period of grieving, wasn't it?
That's... Oh, yes. Very much so, yeah. And when I went out onto... One young man wanted to hang his scarf out on the railings where he used to stand with his friend. His friend had been killed, and I went out with him onto the cop and we hung his scarf over the railings. And standing and looking at that football pitch and the smell of the flowers, and it just felt, everybody was so quiet. I don't know whether you went there, but everybody was so quiet. I thought, it's like being in a cathedral. You know, you could almost feel the atmosphere.
That's a wonderful analogy to make.
It was. That's how it felt.
You must have spoken to a lot of other people there as well.
Oh, yes. Made, you know, got in touch with lots of families and, you know, just allowing them the opportunity to talk through.
And it is just as simple as that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, people say, I mean, what happens very often when people are bereaved is somebody sees you walking along the road and they dash into a shop. Don't want to talk to you because they don't know what to say. But you don't have to say very much. If I see somebody who's just been bereaved, I'll just sort of say to them, you know, I was so sorry to hear about Fred or whoever. You know, is there anything I can do? And just allow them to talk. And people say, well, I don't want to remind her of Avril, because if I remind her of Avril, it'll upset her. Well, come on, she was my daughter. I've never forgotten her. So you reminding me about her is not going to upset me.
How old was Avril when?
Avril was 22.
Right. And what was she like as a person?
Oh, gosh. She was a one-off, I have to say. She had a terrible sense of colour. I often used to say to her, I'm sure you're colour blind, because she'd have bright pink and orange on. or she'd have red and purple on. And I'd say to her, you're not going out dressed like that, are you? What's wrong with it? I think it's lovely. She was larger than life. She really was. She had the most gorgeous, big blue eyes, vivid blue eyes. Very pretty girl.
And as you mentioned earlier there, Rose, if it hadn't have been for the terrible tragedy that befell her, you wouldn't be where you are today.
No, definitely not, no. And I have to say, since Avril's death, I have met so many lovely, lovely people. In my job, I've been very lucky. I've been to 10 Downing Street. I've met Tony Blair. I've met Harriet Harman, Charles Faulkner, loads and loads of government ministers. But I have to be honest and say to you that the people who have really touched my heart have been the ordinary bereaved people. They are just unbelievable. They really are.
So out of your own personal tragedy has come a force for good, really?
I hope so, yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about your visit to Ground Zero.
Oh. I was in the...
And what made you go there?
Well, I was in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office talking to them about issues to do with people, British people who were murdered abroad. And my husband and I had decided we'd go over to New York. And I mentioned that I was going to New York, and they organised for the British consulate out there to look after me when I got there. And they took me to meet the police department, and I met the assistant commissioner and a lieutenant who was actually on duty when the planes hit the towers. And had a lot of talk with them, and then they took me down to Ground Zero, and again, it was an amazing experience because it was so big. It's something like, is it 10 or 12 football pitches?
Oh, yes, sir.
And there were five levels underground. And you were looking down at the firemen working there. And they were like ants. And, you know, they were scurrying away like ants. And the thing that struck me also was that three sides of the square, all the buildings were damaged. The fourth side of the square has a church that's built on St. Martin's in the Field. Not even a window was cracked in that church.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I've been to Ground Zero.
Have
seen
you?
That, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they took us in. This was only a few months after. Then they took us into the church. And the church actually, they'd taken out a row of pews and they'd put beds in there, and they had food and drink, and the firemen were working outside, coming in, having food, drink, and then just crashing out on the beds, having a few hours sleep, and then back out again. And I met a lot of the firemen, talked to them, and then I was taken to the fire department psychological support unit. And when that lady found out that I was a bereaved mother, she asked me would I go to a meeting that evening. And it was about 60 bereaved parents. They were parents of men who had been in the fire department and had died at Ground Zero. And we had a really interesting meeting with them. They said to me, how did you cope in the beginning when Avril died? And I told them the things that had happened to me, and I told them that what had surprised me was that my husband and I, instead of being close together, after a few months we went opposite directions and we were grieving very differently. Now, that happens to a lot of bereaved people. A lot of couples will divorce, doesn't matter whether they're married, single-sex couples or what. If a child is involved and that child dies, they'll often split. Fortunately, we came back together again, and I explained I am very much a feeler. I want to talk about Avril. My husband is a thinker. He's an academic, and pull away. Don't talk to me about that subject, which makes for a recipe for disaster in a marriage or in any partnership. And it was interesting because a ripple went round the room. I thought it was only us. And at the end of the meeting, they actually had a professional facilitator who was a psychologist, and he came up to me afterwards and he said, you have moved them on more in one evening than I've done in 4 months. And I said to him, but that's not because me is wonderful. I said, it's because I'm a bereaved parent and I know exactly what's going on in their heads at the moment. So that was quite an interesting experience.
Yeah, you must have heard some amazing stories, I'm sure, when you were there.
Harrowing.
Was it... Were you there at the time when, because one of the times when I visited, was it all completely covered in all the photographs?
Yes, yeah. Yes. We've actually got a photograph from there on our website. And we took quite a lot of photos there, and we've got one with all the scarves and pictures and everything.
Very moving.
Absolutely, yeah. And I found I'd been to New York about 15 years before. And I didn't really like New York very much because everybody was dashing around everywhere and didn't want to talk to you. But on this occasion, as soon as people heard our accents, they were coming up to us, hugging us and shaking our hands and saying, thank you for your support. We really do appreciate how much you're supporting us.
I went there quite a few times when it was actually, you know, when the buildings were standing and went up to the top to take in the view and go to the restaurants and so on. And then to go back to ground zero... You know, it's almost like going back to that hallowed place.
Yes.
Mm. It creates its own atmosphere, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Because of
yeah. What's
gone on. And you do get that sense of that, don't you? Mm.
Yes. Almost like holy ground.
And I'm sure that I haven't been, but I know you've been to Auschwitz. I'm sure there's a similar sort of feeling there, is there?
Yes. Very, very quiet. No birds. I mean, I'd heard this and I thought, yes, you know, there must be the odd bird somewhere. We never saw a bird anywhere. Quiet and a smell at Auschwitz. I mean, the only way I can describe it is a smell of death. Very, very moving. Became quite distressed by, you know, realising the amount of suffering that had happened there. It also surprised me. I always thought in terms of Auschwitz and Jewish people being killed, but a huge number of Catholics were killed. A huge number of handicapped people were killed.
Even, and gypsies.
Yes.
And gay people.
Yeah. Absolutely. They wouldn't tolerate anything, any deviation from their, you know, their ideal race. That surprised me. But it was very, very moving. I came away and said to my husband, every politician in this world should be made to go to Auschwitz. And if they did, I don't think there'd be another war.
It's interesting. And just very briefly, tell us about the work you do today. Who are you supporting today?
Today I'm supporting not just myself, a team of us support around about 3,000 families who've been bereaved through homicide. That's either murder, manslaughter or terrorist attacks.
And are they feeling the same as somebody like in your situation who, you know, lost a daughter suddenly?
I think they're probably feeling the same as me, but I think for them there's much more to it because the shock and trauma of somebody actually deliberately killing your loved one is horrendous, and then on top of that you know, having to go through the judicial system.
Rose Dixon, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Coming up next.